When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second. Since 1983, Eddie Trunk has been the voice for fans of rock, hard rock, and heavy metal. A best-selling author, host of TV's That Metal Show, and seven national radio shows, including Trunk Nation, daily on Sirius XM.
Interesting.
Eddie offers the world his news-making interviews, passionate analysis, honest commentary, and who knows what else. So welcome to the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Hey, what's up, everybody? It's Eddie Trunk, and you are listening to another edition of the Eddie Trunk Podcast, which is new every Thursday on PodcastOne.com and iTunes, coming to you from the roof of the Chamberlain Hotel in West Hollywood, California this week. I'm out here because Stone Temple Pilots are doing their first ever concert with their new singer the night that I'm recording this, which is Tuesday. You guys are hearing it on post day, which is Thursday. And I had the incredible honor of doing the first ever interview with the new lineup of Stone Temple Pilots to announce who their new lead singer is. By now, you guys know it's a guy by the name of Jeff Gutt. And they just played their first show with him, which was at the Troubadour that I had a chance to attend this past Tuesday in L.A. At the time I'm recording this, I didn't see the show yet, so I'd be lying to you if I had told you how it was. But I will tell you about it next week, or of course on the radio show as well. So I recorded yesterday, and again, I'm doing this on the Tuesday before this post. So yesterday I recorded a special with Stone Temple Pilots where we revealed for Sirius XM the new singer. I think a lot of people probably thought this guy was going to be from an established band or from a big name or something like that. And obviously by now you know he's not. He was an X Factor contestant at one point. I met him. I interviewed him. Hopefully you heard that special on Sirius XM. Seems like a real nice guy. Seems like a good fit for the band. I did hear music that they made with him, and it sounded really good. And the DeLeo brothers are good friends, as is Eric Kretz, great guy as well. Really good guys in Stone Temple Pilots. And they've been through so much. Two singers, Don, and trying to just kind of, you know, so much great music they're trying to keep alive. And what's really important to them is they want to have their new music be as good as the old music. A lot of the what went into them deciding who the new singer was going to be is derived by the fact of how things work with them as far as making new music and the creative aspects of writing music. So that's a big reason why they picked this guy as well. Interestingly enough, he was telling me that he's way more into playing guitar than he is being a singer and a frontman. So that's kind of interesting. It's kind of like Miles Kennedy in Alter Bridge, same deal. He's a kind of a reluctant lead singer when he just sings, which he does in Slash's band, because Miles will be the first one to tell you he's way more into guitar, and that was his thing. He just so happens to be blessed with this incredible voice. So I don't think Jeff is going to play guitar in STP. It's kind of built as a one-guitar band, but he's apparently quite an accomplished guitarist, but he is their new singer. I wish those guys nothing but the best. I'll tell you about what the live show was like when I have a chance to check it out. If you have Sirius XM, they're going to air the entire show from the Troubadour tomorrow on a couple different channels, including Howard 101. So you'll be able to hear it. And if you go on demand, you'll be able to hear my interview, the first interview and the interview that revealed to the world who the new singer was. And I really appreciate those guys asking me to do so many cool things with them. I did the 25th anniversary of Core for them, and now having this opportunity has been really cool, and I really enjoyed it. So thanks to STP, and nothing but the best for them going forward with Jeff Gut, their new lead singer, which was revealed exclusively on a special that I did with those guys that premiered this past Tuesday night on SiriusXM. So that's what I'm out here in L.A. for. At the time you hear this on Thursday, I'll be back in Jersey and New York and finishing out a week of radio. As far as upcoming appearances are concerned, you'll be able to catch me at in Tulsa on December 1st, the IDL Ballroom, hosting Lita Ford and Jack Russell's Great White. Matter of fact, Lita was on my radio show the other day. Some really interesting discussion about her book and the whole thing with Tony Iommi. I hope you had a chance to hear that interview. So I'll be in Tulsa on the 1st. Then on the 2nd, I run over to Southern California again at the Canyon Club in Agora Hills, hosting a show there on that Saturday night, Frontiers Records Holiday Party, featuring L.A. Guns, Warrant, Jack Russell's Great White, and also River Dogs. And then after that, it's Dallas, December 16th, the Bomb Factory for the holiday Christmas show there with Ace Frehley, LA Guns, and more. And that's pretty much, well, there might be something added any second in Houston, actually. So keep an eye on my website, as usual, all my appearances as they come in on the homepage of eddietrunk.com. So have a look at that. There might be an additional thing added in mid-December in Houston. I just don't have confirmation on it at the time I'm doing this. So I'll keep you posted through the website, Twitter at Eddie Trunk, Instagram at Eddie Trunk, Facebook fan page at Eddie Trunk. As I always say, Twitter, where I would be the most active and most up to the second with my information. Speaking of SiriusXM, the Bruce Dickinson interview that I did a couple weeks ago. Of course, Bruce Dickinson from Iron Maiden making the rounds, promoting his autobiography, What Does This Button Do?, and a fun read. I got to skim through some of it. Bruce came by, and we did a really cool interview where we talked about a lot of stuff. It was also broadcast on Facebook Live, and it was a great conversation with Bruce, and that's what I have for you is this week's interview. A lot of interesting sort of news was made out of this. One of the bigger things that people talked about was the fact that the interview with Bruce, he talked about the Three Tremors thing and how that was originally supposed to be Ronnie James Dio instead of Jeff Tate. Talked about the air raid siren thing and how a fan actually gave him that name. It was kind of a diss on him. So there's some fun stuff in here, and Bruce obviously pushing this autobiography and, you know, the next phase of Maiden, which has just been announced as well. By the way, speaking of Maiden, the Monsters of Rock cruise is coming up. Steve Harris is doing his band British Lion on the cruise. I'm definitely going to be broadcasting my SiriusXM show from two, possibly three cruises. Definitely Cruise to the Edge, definitely the Monsters of Rock cruise, and possibly one other. The Moody Blues cruise is looking good too. So I'll be on board a bunch of ships coming up in the new year, bringing you my radio show on SiriusXM, Trunk Nation, which can be heard every day live, 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern time, replay 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern, and on demand as well on the SiriusXM app. Of course, over the air across America and Canada on Channel 106. And as usual, the interviews you hear on the Eddie Trunk podcast originate from the radio show, and you're just getting a small sample what I do on a daily basis on the radio show. So hope if you don't have SiriusXM, hope you come on board and join me. So great to be here again in Southern California, and just getting a little break to be able to set this podcast up for you for the week. And I'm going to kind of get out of the way quickly this week so that we can get to the Bruce Dickinson interview. And let's do that right now, as a matter of fact. So take a break. We'll come back. And the leader and voice of Iron Maiden, Bruce Dickinson, he joins me on the Eddie Trunk Podcast. Stick around.
The Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Hey, guys, let me tell you about TrueCar, because I've been telling you about it for a while, and it really is a tremendous service, because when you're looking to buy a car, you want to make sure that you're getting real pricing on actual inventory. And unfortunately, a lot of times, this just isn't the case. You see, people configure cars online only to find out later that the cars aren't available. With TrueCar, you get real pricing on actual inventory. It's not pricing offered by TrueCar, but pricing offered by an actual dealer. And not just any dealer, but a TrueCar certified dealer. This is a carefully curated network of dealers committed to transparency and offering you a competitive market price. Using TrueCar, you can easily find the car you want. Next, TrueCar will allow you to see what other people paid for the same car. How helpful is that? And that is a big, big plus. And now you have fair pricing, and you can feel confident about that pricing. Over 3 million cars have been sold to TrueCar by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network, and there's over 13,000 TrueCar Certified Dealers nationwide. You'll work directly with a TrueCar Certified Dealer, and that is a big, big plus, because TrueCar users, well, they're more likely to enjoy a faster buying process when they connect with TrueCar Certified Dealers. You ready for this? TrueCar users, they save an average of over $3,000 off MSRP. Who doesn't want $3,000 saved, right? So when you're ready to buy, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states.
Do you want to be great at reading body language, developing persuasion and influence, as well as master rapport and social interaction? What if I told you that you would learn from top performers like NBA superstar Shaquille O'Neal, former CIA director Michael Hayden, and brilliant thinkers like Dirty Jobs Mike Rowe? Take a minute right now and subscribe to the Art of Charm podcast with me, Jordan Harbinger, and you'll hear how I pull out the secret psychology, life experience, and wisdom that can only be learned from them. You'll hear Shaq talk about how to manage your career and how to know who to trust when everyone's out to get something from you. You'll discover how to think critically from Bill Nye and Neil deGrasse Tyson, and even how Tony Hawk's life as a skateboard icon will influence how you think about your career and relationships in a whole new way. This show is for you if you want to outcompete, outperform, and outthink everyone around you, and it's the only place you'll get practical, applicable strategies from every single episode. Since you're all about learning from the absolute best, download and subscribe for free right now and upgrade your brain 4 times a week at podcastone.com or in the Podcast One app.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
All right, we're back with the Eddie Trunk Podcast. Let's get into it right now. Our interview this week is with Bruce Dickinson of Iron Maiden, and this is courtesy of my radio show on Sirius XM. Check it out. Hope you guys enjoy it. Congratulations.
Oh, yes.
What does this button do?
Yeah, I've still got no idea, but yeah, you've enjoyed reading the Book of Lies, have you? That's great. You
know, there you go. Book of Souls, the last Maiden record, now this would be the Book of Lies. I got to tell you, though, I've not yet had the time to read it word for word, page for page, mm-hmm. but I've had a chance to go through it and get the gist of it, and certainly know, as being a lifelong Maiden fan, enough about your story. And I thought it was a great read. I thought it was funny. You had a great sense of humor about it. And I guess my biggest question to start out about the book is, why now? Like, why was this the right time for you to write your story?
Well, the last time I was here, I'd just gotten over this whole, like, throat cancer thing. So I was on the big tour to talk about the new album and not to be too dark about it, to persuade people that I was not checking out, you know. So that seemed to me to be a good end point for a book. Not that I'm thinking of ending anything, but it's, you know, the getting the all clear and from the whole throat cancer thing struck me as being a good way to end a book and a good way to start the rest of your life. Mm. And 10 years or so, people have been asking me to do an autobiography. I know that sports stars write autobiographies when they're 25, and then subsequently when they're 26, and then when they're 27, and then whenever they develop some new life skill or reality show, they write another one. Right. And I didn't want to do that. I thought that we'll just do one. And this kind of provoked it, the whole thing about the throat cancer scare. And I thought, you know, I should probably get on with this. Just, yeah, you never know, just in case, you know. So that's why now.
You mentioned when we last talked, which was around the promo for the Book of Souls, we had done a few things together. And I admit I was kind of surprised that you were the representative sort of picked by management and the band to go out there and do the promo for that, considering what you had just come off of, the chemo, which is documented in the book, and the cancer.
Yeah.
So was that the mentality of it? Was kind of like, let's let everybody know the singer's okay?
Yeah, yeah. And that, and, you know, I just need the air miles, you know.
Well, you do you even collect air miles anymore since you actually fly the plane?
Miles? You don't get air miles for flying the plane. You know, that's the, unfortunately. If I did, then, I don't know what I'd do with them all.
You can't be upgraded anymore. You're flying the plane.
Yeah.
There's nowhere to go further up.
No, there's nowhere to be. Yeah, but you get upgraded and it's no use because, you know, you're at the front and you can't even sit back and have a beer, you know.
So, the title of the book, What Does This Button Do? Where did that come from?
It is what people say when they get into an airplane cockpit or they get into a flight simulator or whatever. And the first thing, like, just people have never been in one before. They go, what do all these buttons do? You know, and so, you know, pilots always make a joke out of it. They're like, yeah, oh, I don't know. You know, let's see. What does this button do? And I thought that it was kind of a metaphor for my life, because that basically I've lived my life by the philosophy of I wonder what happens if I do this. Like, I wonder what happens if I leave Iron Maiden. I don't know, you know. And, you know, wonder what happens if I join a rock band. I wonder what happens if I decide to pee in my headmaster's dinner. You know, so all of those stories, in a bizarre way, the book almost looks like there was an intention behind everything, but actually, it's kind of random.
Yeah. When I think of you and I think of Maiden in general, I think of a band that's very sort of private and insulated in terms of sharing a lot of public stories. Like, all good guys, all fun guys. I've had the pleasure of knowing the guys and hanging out and knowing the band since I just found my copy of The Number of the Beast signed by you and Steve when I broke into radio. So that's how far back I go when I remember. But not a band that's ever out there in the gossipy circles, a band as big as Maiden, you could understand showing up on the Page Sixes of the world or whatever, but sort of very private. So was there any pushback from anybody within the camp or even the notorious Rod Smallwood, like, hey, you know, it's not the time to do that?
Nobody's read it.
Nobody's read it?
No. Nobody read it. I mean, Rod read through it He made some comments, and I went, okay, well, let's just see where we go when we finish the edit process. And the edit process was, you see, I wrote the, there's no ghostwriter here. So I wrote this book, and I wrote it longhand on seven.
On paper.
Pen and paper. With a biro on paper, yeah. So I wrote 160,000 words on paper. And there's about 105,000 words in there, so we edited out the rest, the 40 something thousand words. And the reason we edited them out, because my editor, the wonderfully named Jack Fogg, with two G's, so he's like, you know, doubly obscured. So Jack said, look, he said, this is a great read, but I want it to read like a novel. I want it to be a real page turner. So when you've got three stories about an airplane, one after the other, we don't need three. We just need one.
Right.
So I took it on board. I went, yeah, okay, great. Even though they're good stories. So the, you know, there were some stories about, you know, a couple of drunken nights with here, there and everywhere and things. And they were great stories. But he said, look, we've got one story about that. So we don't need another one and another one and another one. I went, yeah, OK, fair point. Because otherwise, at 400 pages, the book's a thundering good read. And I know some people have gone, you know, I read it at one sitting. You know, I think that's kind of intrepid. But still, you know, it makes the point that it's not like a doorstep or a weapon of mass destruction.
No, know? But the thing that I loved about it, because that's the challenge for me doing what I do, is sometimes I'm given a book like this 2 days before I have to interview the person, much like this instance was. And I'm like, oh, geez, I'm not actually going to be able to get through all of this. But it kept me – I was up till 3:30 saying, well, I got to read about this part. And you get to the point.
Yeah. Some of the chapter headings, I mean, were the very last thing we did. There were no chapters in this book. I mean, the whole thing is one long 700 pages of handwritten script, which we obviously turned into a typewritten script. And actually,
whose job was that?
Mary at the office. Mary.
Oh, wow.
Fantastic. Anybody who's in the Maiden fan club who's listening to this, bow down and worship Mary Henry at the Maiden office.
So she was given handwritten sheets of paper.
Because initially, HarperCollins, obviously the publishers, they said, we'll get this stuff translated. I went, oh, okay. Who's going to be the lucky person to do that? He goes, oh, we send it off to India. I mean, you send it to India, which, of course, is where Rod Smallwood is at the moment, you know, getting dysentery.
Riding
bicycles. No, he's not doing that. But no, he's on a charity bike ride at the moment in India. But so they send it to India. I don't know why. I mean, maybe they have some, you know. But whatever the Google Translate version of my handwriting in India is not really suitable for publication. It came back with, it was hilarious. It was malapropisms and everything all over the place. I mean, and some of them were so classic. We didn't have time, but we were almost tempted to do the alternate version of the book as translated by the Indians. You know, so supersonic firework became supersonic jacuzzi, and there was like loads of it. So in the end, Mary said, I can read his handwriting, which surprised the hell out of me because I can't read my handwriting. But
why did you do it that way?
I'm a terrible typist. I didn't have the time to acquire the skills to become a better typist I'm two fingers. I mean,
me know, too.
Hunt and peck. But I can't abide to see spelling mistakes. And so I have to correct them. I can't go on and have spelling. And I hate spell check and Google this and Google that. And did you really mean to use that word? You know, and it's like, yes, I did. If I didn't want to use that word, I'd have asked you, you schmuck, you know, don't you automate me, you asshole, you know. So that's why I hand wrote it, because the flow just keeps going and you don't have to stop for spelling mistakes and interrupt the flow.
And when did you actually do it? Because Maiden had a pretty full schedule recently. How long ago did you start to set in on this? Did you do it on the road?
Yeah, I did. Well, I had to because I started far too late. I mean, I knew I was supposed to do this months before I actually started doing it. I had a deadline of this March this year. I started writing it in the middle of February.
Oh my gosh.
So
don't tell me you made the deadline.
Oh no. I knew I was gonna blow, the risk would be falling off, man. I knew I was gonna blow through the deadline. But at the same time I said, what's the last possible day I could finish this before you have to move the print date? And bless them. I mean, poor old Jack was sweating bullets, I think. I was actually still writing it. During the US tour, I was still finishing it up. Wow. During the US tour. Cause I ended up writing more than I intended. Initially I wanted to write more of a memoir, less of an autobiography.
What would be the difference between those two for people that don't know?
Well, an autobiography is a kind of a timeline from, you know, beginning to now or near as damn it. Memoir, you can kind of pick what you want to talk
jump
around a bit, and you can shape it sort of how you want. That was initially my idea. And as soon as I started writing it, I realized that actually the timeline, it was an autobiography. So why struggle and call it a memoir when it was an autobiography? Which pleased Jack, my editor, no end, because he said, look, we'd really like the autobiography bit to be in there because people understand what they're getting.
Right.
You know, with a memoir, they're like, what's this then? You know,
Right. Well, and that's exactly what it does. It starts off in your youth and goes right through and covers so much ground. But, you know, again, I go back to the fact that when I look at Maiden, I mean, you're the first guy in the band to write an autobiography and really tell the story.
Yeah.
So you didn't have any sort of dialogue with anybody in the camp. When did they about doing this? And there were no reservations that, oh, well, I don't know if we should have any. I know this is your story, but your story also has a lot to do with Maiden's story.
It does. And you've got to be, you know, you've got to be a bit circumspect about how you deal with other people's lives. Because, you know, I made a ground rule for myself that, you know, I would reveal things about myself because it's my book, but I wouldn't reveal things that I thought were inappropriate about other people because it's not their book.
Right.
And if they want to reveal things in their own way, that's up to them. I mean, I had loads of people, old acquaintances, wives of various shades and, you know, everything else coming up going, am I in the book? You know, I want to see if I'm in the book, you know. I want approval on whether or not I'm in the book or not, you know. And I was just like, nah.
No, they're not in it, or no, they can't have approval, or both.
Well, I just like, well, I don't know. You'd have to wait and see. It's like, oh, if there's anything horrible about it, and then, you know, and I didn't have the heart to tell them that they're not in the book
because you made a conscious decision,
yeah,
where you weren't going to go in this story,
yeah, because again, wives and everything else, that just leads down the road towards kind of tittle-tattle and you're into sort of like Hello Magazine world and everything. And it overwhelms what I think are some of the better stories of the book, which is the story about creativity, the stories about, you know, upbringing and how you got put together and how you ended up doing all these oddball things in your life. And again, in terms of kids and all the rest of it, it's, you know, I love my kids, but you're not really doing them any favors by dragging them through a book. It's also kind of not their book. I mean, I'm their dad, so they could read the book and go, wow, Dad, I never realized you did that, you know.
Were there any things that you, in those pages that you cut out that you wrote, that you regret not being in there, that you wish would have been included?
Oh, there's some great yes, but only because they're funny. Uh-huh. And literally there were things edited out that were only edited out for reasons of length, not because they were kind of inappropriate or like, oh, we can't say that, you know.
So for the people that maybe, because this book is out now, people have read it and everything.
Yeah.
So for the people that, and we won't talk more specifically about what is in the book, but is there one thing that comes to mind that's a funny story that you had to cut out that kind of pained you to do so that you could share with the audience?
We cut out quite a lot of stuff about the early years of Samson, for example, because Samson, we were like the bad news. We were like the bad
for people
news
that
band.
Don't know the band you were in prior to joining Iron
exactly.
Maiden,
and that's one of the reasons why it got edited out, because, you know, I think people thought, well, you know, there's quite a lot of stuff in here about a band that not many people have heard of, but some of the things that we got up to were just hilarious. I mean, we were so stupid. I mean, it was beyond Spinal Tap. I mean,
that don't know Samson, the drummer went by the name of Thunderstick.
Correct.
And he wore, I never even knew this because, correct me if I'm wrong, Samson never toured America, right?
Mm-hmm. Samson never toured anywhere outside of the UK. never even got on a ferry and went across the channel, you know?
Thunderstick wore while he played sort of like a bondage
it was
mask.
It was a gimp mask.
Yes. But was he ever seen without it, or was that sort of a mystique thing?
Well, you know, if you ever saw him without it, you'd prefer he put it back on. That's being uncharitable to Barry. I've revealed his true name. Everybody knows his real name. He was, as I described in the little talks I'm doing and things like that, he actually was a very strange musical amalgam. He absolutely worshipped Kiss. So the whole idea of the mask was all based upon the whole Kiss thing, mm-hmm. of the anonymity and, right. and what have you. And he would paint black grease paint underneath the mask. So that's all you could see was the black eyes and black lips and stuff. And he also adopted the very strange and rather disturbing habit of not uttering human speech whilst he was wearing the mask, which made sound checks very difficult.
He wouldn't speak?
He would grunt. I mean, this is just, this is better than Spinal Tap. Spinal Tap never dreamt this stuff up, you know, I mean, this is real. He would sort of go, how's the bass drum? You know, he goes, well, okay, I'll take that as a yes then, you know.
The Gimp in Pulp Fiction.
Well, yes, but the trouble was that it was all so badly timed because, unfortunately, shortly after he adopted the mask and everything else, there was a rather unfortunate case of mass murder in the UK in which the mass murderer happened to wear a mask that looked just like his. And she was like, oh, no, really? You know, so it became, oh, that was it. It was a guy, he was called the Cambridge Rapist. And he wore a mask like that. And so his mask, instead of being Thunderstick, it became known as the Rapist Mask. And we were like, this is not
great marketing for a band.
This is not what is intended at all. Are you kidding me? And he would say things like, it's not a rapist mask. It's different. I said, how is it different? He goes, oh, I've got a little sort of mane on top. He didn't. I'm like, I don't think that's quite the point here, you know. But anyway. So,
did you think... you know, I found an interesting part in the book was about that transition for you from Samson and sort of moving into Maiden. You had seen Maiden before you joined the band. You guys opened for them or vice versa?
Oh, yeah. There was very incestuous tours used to go on back then where we'd do 4 or 5 act bills and you do like a, you know, 1200 seater or something else like that, or colleges or whatever. And it was billed as being the heavy metal crusade, you know, and we're not quite sure what you were crusading against, but anyway, it sounded kind of good at the time, I guess. And so there were a bunch of bands and we all knew each other and we were all on the same circuit. And actually, Samson's management were involved in sort of promoting some of these things. So actually, Samson very often ended up headlining and Maiden ended up supporting them, which, I mean, it really should have been the other way around because all these people showed up for Maiden, the place was packed out. And then as soon as Maiden finished, everybody left.
Yeah.
we headlined to about, you know, like 30 people. We were like, what's going on here then, you know?
Yeah, but you talk about what I found really interesting is that when you would see Maiden, of course, Paul Di'Anno was their singer at the time, you were pretty confident, like in your mind, you said, I'm going to be the singer in that band.
Oh, yeah.
You had designs on it from the moment you saw that.
Yeah, it was just blindingly obvious to me that the noises they were making and the musicality of it and everything else, I was like, I should be singing for those guys.
But did you feel that there was some disconnect with their singer? Because there are people to this day that still love those records that Paul did with the band. Mm-hmm. But there were also people...
Everybody except Steve Harris.
But there are people, like I saw, the first time I saw Maiden was on the Killers tour with Paul. And it seemed to me that he was coming from a different place in the way he fronted the band, the way he sang.
Yeah,
did that resonate with you at the time? Say, well, I should be doing that.
No, I mean, it wasn't so much a question of, you know, what he was doing. It was a question of what I thought that I could do to add to the whole thing. You know, I mean, you know, he had a style which was
kind of,
you know,
punk.
Yeah, and it was unique, which I take the point. But there was so much that was in there that was just latent, if you like. Our paths were just sort of intertwined for the next, you know, year and a half. You know, we ended up in the same studio next door to each other. You know, Samson were doing a record and Maiden were doing Killers at the same time. Clive Burr was the drummer in Samson for about 18 months before he joined Maiden. Mm. So, you know, I mean, everybody knew everybody. We all knew each other. Everybody knew everybody else, you know. And we were, you know, we're all drinking together and hanging out together and listening to each other's stuff. So everybody was aware of what everybody could, what we could do, what our, you know, our musical possibilities were, I suppose. And then whatever happened with Maiden and Paul, I wasn't in the band, but clearly it wasn't working out. And I talk about, you know, Reading Festival, when Steve and Rod turned up to look at me. I was in Samson doing the second time we'd done Reading Festival. And it was, you know, really successful. But Samson itself was starting to crumble and sort of implode a little bit. Paul was much more into the whole blues type thing. It was more bluesy, ZZ Toppy type thing. And I was much more into the whole... the more big, dramatic metal kind of type songs. Amongst other things, I mean, people like A&M Records actually wanted to sign Samson, but they made it perfectly clear that what they were interested in was me, not the band.
Right.
And I was like, well, I'm, you know, 21 something years old, and I do not want to be a solo artist, you know, age 21. Huh? Nobody's even heard of me, you know, so why would I want to be a solo artist?
Right.
I want to be in a band. And I always have wanted to be in a band. Even when I left Maiden, the first thing I wanted to do was form a band and make it work that way. That's how I'm comfortable, and that's what floats my boat, you know.
One of the interesting things is the... At the time Maiden approached you and you had that meeting with Rod where you said, you know, you talk about it in the book, come over here a second, let's talk for a few seconds.
Yeah.
You from that moment sort of laid down the gauntlet in saying how it's going to be. And that's a real, that was a really interesting thing to me that you had the sort of bravado at the time to say, okay, you guys want me. I know what I can bring to this thing, but here's what's going to happen. And you're not going to get a new guy you're going to be able to roll over on a little bit. So the way you came at that, I think probably was a smart thing to set that precedent at the very beginning.
Yeah, but it was, it's just comes from, a natural amount of self-confidence. And I'm not really sure where that comes from. I think a lot of it comes from probably fear of failure. So you have to front...
But you talk about your ego in the book and how you control it and the balloon and all that sort of stuff too.
Well, that comes after, you know, a few hundred shows. You think, you know, how do you cope with all this? Because sometimes you do and sometimes you don't. But as you get older, it gets a little bit... easier because you've been around the block a few times and you hopefully grow up a little bit, but not too much.
But to go up to Steve and Rod when they're talking to you about being the singer, and deep down inside you
but Steve wasn't there.
It was just Rod.
It was just Rod.
But yeah. So you already had your eyes on becoming the singer in this band. Now you know they're coming at you to kind of check it out and make the offer. It's still a sort of ballsy thing at that point to say, okay, but here's how it's going to go, as opposed to saying, yes, please take me in Maiden. I know the band's going to blow up. That says a lot, I think.
Well, yeah, because I was serious about it. You know, I didn't want to I wasn't joining Maiden because, you know, I wanted a good paycheck.
Right.
You know, it was, you know, we were going to take on the world and we were going to win, yeah. You know, and we were going to do amazing things. And the only way you do amazing things is by... doing the difficult things. And sometimes the difficult things are things that you disagree on and things, but you've got to work through it. And if Maiden had a reputation amongst musicians as being a revolving door, joining Iron Maiden was pretty regarded as being pretty a kind of a poisoned chalice, you know. Oh, you got a job with Maiden? Huh? You'll be gone in 6 months, you know. And they'd had, I don't know how many singers they'd had, drummers. That Thunderstick was Maiden's drummer at one point. He lasted one.
With the mask?
No, he lasted one show. Apparently, Steve told me the story. And in actual fact, there was some legal thing whereby we did a song on Samsung called Thunderburst, which was an intro that we did. And I hadn't heard the Iron Maiden song, Ides of March. And when I did, I went, this is the same song, you know, basically, you know. And so there was some legal nonsense about the song. And I said, well, you know, Mr. Thunderstick, this appears to be this. How come you wrote a song that's almost the same song as this Maiden song? And, of course, he was in the band for one show. Mm. So that was the argument. But Steve tells a story of how they were at doing a pub show, and they were playing, and Thunderstick went off at, or it wasn't Thunderstick back then, but whatever it was, Barry went off and did a drum solo, and so they all went off, and there's this drum solo going on, and he stops in the middle of it. And bear in mind, this is a pub in the East End, and you know, so one or two people are down the back, you know, having the temerity to talk during his drum solo and drink beer. And he stood up and said, "Silence and listen to the master." And I think,
talk about bravado.
And I think that was his, you know, that was his ticket to the unemployment line at that moment. But Maiden had a reputation, and in fact, and Steve had a reputation as somebody who didn't suffer fools gladly. And, you know, In actual fact, people used to refer to him as the Ayatollah, kind of behind his back. And anyway, I met Steve and I thought, well, it doesn't seem much like an Ayatollah to me. You know, it seems perfectly, you know, sensible sort of guy, you know, knows what he wants, you know, seems fairly determined. And but that's not, I don't think that's particularly a hanging offence, is it? You know. And Rod, of course, had a reputation of being a fearsome manager, and he was absolutely, you know, backing up Steve 100% of the way. So there was no way you could, you know, put a wedge between those two individuals. So it was a very, very, very powerful, you know, axis. And so when I got offered the job, I went, you know what? I'm the singer. So should be a pretty important element to this whole thing. I'm kind of creative, so I have no intention of coming on board and then leaving in 6 months. So you better tell me right now if you want some kind of lapdog just to go and do as he's told, in which case I'll walk, because I'm not that person. I assume you're asking me to join because you don't want that person. Because if we have something where we disagree, it's going to get better, not worse.
Yeah.
And Rod was like, well, maybe. You know, and I said, well, I'll take that as a yes then. But I still had to go and audition. I mean, I still had to go and show up. But I was really confident that when I did actually open up the pipes, that we'd have a great time. And the first audition the first rehearsal we had, basically, Paul was still in the band, but he wasn't there. And it was all very kind of secretive and a bit furtive. And it was a bit sad, really, because I felt sorry for them. Because they were obviously the morale was obviously really weird, because they knew that the singer was going, and I think obviously things were at a bit of a low ebb. It must have been pretty harsh going on and performing, you know, like in that sort of situation. So I thought, well, let's just go and have some fun and just sing some tunes. And we all, you know, jammed, and I played the drums for a bit, and, you know, Clive played bass for a bit, and, you know, we just played, you know. Like musos should do, really.
Yeah.
And we had such a great time. Steve, it before cell phones, you know, it was one of the days where you had to pay phones and put like money in the slot, you know. So Steve phoned Rod. He said, yeah, let's do it. You know, can we get a recording studio this afternoon? And let's put him in the studio and see if it all works. And Rod was like, hold on. Are you really sure about this? And Steve was like, piss off, let's just do it now. And Rod said, wait till after you've done the Swedish tour or whatever it was. So there's some festivals they had to do. So I went away and I thought, well, that seemed to go pretty good. And 2 weeks later, we went into a recording studio, and I did four songs that they had live tracks of with Paul singing on them. And that we just used the backing tracks. And I overdubbed my voice so they could hear it in the studio and be a bit more kind of forensic about it, if you like, which is fair enough. And then that was it. We shook hands and went, well, let's get on with it then.
Yeah. Well, listen, I could spend, we have about 20 minutes left, and I could spend easily going forward with Maiden, because what's really interesting is from there, you talk about how quickly some headbutting happened with Steve when you realize there's, interesting stuff about, moving the wedges around. And why
I've still
is the
got the chips on my teeth.
Why is the bass player out front and you're fighting and he's hitting you? And it's like you quickly had to get some sort of boundaries to say, hey, I'm the singer and I should be out front. But again, this is all stuff you can read about in Bruce's book, which is called What Does This Button Do? We don't want to give it all away, but from where it goes from there is phenomenal, because of course, you make your first record with Maiden, which is rightfully regarded as one of the greatest records of all time, which is The Number of the Beast. You get to work with one of your heroes in Martin Birch.
Yeah.
And all those stories about the fact that The Number of the Beast was done so quickly and Martin Birch destroying the console at the end. And it's trust me, folks, it's all in here. You want to read it. Some other stuff, though, that we'll touch on from the book. With Bruce Dickinson. We got to hit a break. We'll come back. We'll have a few more minutes left because, again, obviously Maiden is the big point that a lot of people want to know and read about. But it's a much bigger story than that. It's before Maiden. It's time out from Maiden. It's coming back to Maiden.
The template for the book that I looked at here is a book that, obviously there's a huge musical component to it, but music's not the only thing I've done in my life. And there's a lot of great stories about, going to Sarajevo.
Yes.
And flying airlines and doing fancy, all these things that I've done. And the whole idea was, a while back there was a biography when I was growing up by an actor called David Niven. Mm-hmm. And it was a biography, it's called The Moon's a Balloon. And it was a go-to biography for everybody because it was just a really uplifting romp through somebody's life with great stories. And at the end of it, you just thought, wow, I feel like I've just been sitting, in a pub with this guy. Although in David Niven's case, it would probably be sitting on a yacht in the Mediterranean drinking champagne. But, you've just been sitting here in conversation for all day,
Yeah.
And that was the idea of the style in when I wrote the book.
It's a great read. You guys are going to love it. We'll come back a few more minutes with Bruce Dickinson here on Trunk Nation on Sirius XM 106 Volume. Again, the book is called What Does This Button Do? And it is available everywhere now. A little more with Bruce right after this.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Hey, are you in need of great talent for your business, but you're short on time? Well, you don't have to get lost in a huge stack of resumes to find your perfect hire. You just need the right tools. You need smarter tools. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click. So you can rest easy knowing your job is being seen by the right candidates. Then ZipRecruiter puts its smart matching technology to work, actively notifying qualified candidates about your job within minutes of posting, so you receive the best possible matches. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other hiring sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidates finding you, it finds them. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by growing businesses of all sizes and industries to find out the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, you heard me right, free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/trunk, T-R-U-N-K. That's ZipRecruiter.com/trunk. One more time, for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/trunk.
Podcast One has crime and mystery with shows like Cold Case Files.
Unsure of how his victim was killed, the doctor completes his autopsy with more questions than answers.
The Serial Killer Podcast.
A little boy, as it turned out, was the kidnapped Billy Gaffney.
And crime in sports.
He's pulled over in Dallas and found in possession of a crack pipe. Let's just say the lawsuit didn't go anywhere. He didn't win.
Exclusively on Podcast One and Apple Podcasts.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
So I would certainly suggest, as I do with music, the actual physical copy. You've got some great photos here in the center that I'm sure that was a tough process with all the times you've been photographed to pick what to include.
But there's a surprising lack of photographs from childhood.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, literally, people said, oh, you must have loads of photographs when you were a kid. I went, no. You know, so, you know, I went around and I found a couple of old passport photographs and stuff. And they're pretty scary looking things, you know.
I like the I'm looking at the photo page now, which shows you your fashion choices throughout your career.
Oh, yeah.
And
with the
caption, all in the best possible taste.
Yeah, absolutely.
Was that always was that a challenge for you throughout your career to figure out to have? So, was there such thing as a Bruce Dickinson image that you tried to cultivate at all? Or was it?
No, it was just it was more or less a sort of an unmitigated disaster zone, really. You know, I think it was I liken it to walking blindfold through a charity shop, you know. that's my chic. That's as far as I get in terms of being fashionable, you know, and it's as close as I ever want to be.
So was there anybody, you know, lead singer, major global rock band, was there anybody in your ear about that saying, hey, maybe we should get you to work with somebody to wear this or wear that, or you would have just brushed them off anyway?
Maiden, you're gonna be kidding me. No, we'd run a mile from that sort of thing. No.
You talk about playing in Sarajevo when you were out of Maiden on your solo tour, and that's a big part of the book as well. That, in a nutshell, why at the time did you opt to go to a war zone and play a show?
Well, somebody asked me.
It was that simple?
Simple as that. And I said, would you like to come to Sarajevo and do a show? And I went, isn't there a war? And the guy went, well, yeah, but you'd be guests at the UN and it would make everybody feel real, real good. And I went, oh, okay, I'll talk to the guys. So I spoke to the guys and said, you know, would you like to go Sarajevo? We've got this offer. And they said, isn't there a war? I went, yeah, I understand there is. But, you know, apparently we'd all go in helicopters and we'd have little blue helmets and it would all be fixed up and it'd all be organized. And they went, oh, okay. Yeah, okay. So we turned up and we got there and there were no blue helmets and there were no helicopters and it wasn't organized and we went anyway. And the story that's in the book is quite an interesting story, quite moving in many ways, and all the more interesting because really nobody knew that we were doing it. But 20 years after, a local film director has made a documentary about it. And he's gone back and found footage of the show. He's found all the kids who were there at the show, aged sort of 12, 13, 14 years old. And he's interviewed all these guys and girls now and gone, what did that show mean to you? And how has it changed your life? Now, has it reflected? And it's heart-stopping footage. I mean, you know, people talking about how they got there, you know, how people shot at them to get there, or how they were dodging snipers to get to the show. I mean, it's quite extraordinary what went on. And that's going to be released in February next year.
Well, look forward to seeing that for sure. Again, jumping around here because limited time and so much to cover from Bruce's book. You've got the stuff about your love of aviation and becoming a pilot as you are today. A couple of things that jumped out to me that were interesting as a fan, the approach was made to Vincent Price to do the voiceover on The Number of the Beast.
Mr. Price doesn't get out of bed for less than $10,000.
That was the response.
Yeah.
Which you say rightfully that a lot of people actually think that still is Vincent Price, the guy you use.
Yeah, of course they do. It's an actor who used to read the ghost story on a radio station in London. And I said, well, why don't we use this guy? He sounds kind of like Vincent Price. And he was like $300, you know.
And we're talking about the intro voice to the song, The Number of the Beast.
To you, Earth and Sea. And he was brilliant. The guy came in, and I was there when he was doing it. He did like 10 takes, and every single one was gold, you know. And Martin just said, that's Frank Brooks, you know, here's $300.
So, yeah. And early on, you were given the name of the Air Raid Siren. And the origins of how you got that name are in the book as well.
It was like an early. I mean, obviously, we didn't get trolled like you get trolled now. You know, on a professional basis, but in websites and things because there weren't any. But you did get letters of complaint, which was the equivalent to a troll, and so this guy saw me doing the show at the Rainbow Theatre when I first joined Maiden, and we did 5 warm-up shows, culminating in one in London. And he wrote a letter saying, I hate this new singer. It's like listening to all my favourite songs being played through an air raid siren. And so Rod went, brilliant. The human air raid siren, and and that was how he invented the name, you know.
And again, just jumping around, there's this. If you're a metal fan, there's this elusive thing that we've heard about for years of the three tremors, and you talk about that in the book,
yeah.
Because which I found really fascinating, the original third person beside yourself and Halford, Ronnie James Dio, which would have been amazing.
Ronnie, and I was like, I am not going to do this without Ronnie. And Rod was like, oh, I don't want to use Ronnie; he's too old. I said, what do you mean too old? Are you kidding me? I mean, I said he's a legend. He said, no. I said we should use Jeff Tate. I said, I don't want to use Jeff Tate. And then we had a meeting with Jeff Tate. And then I said, no, it's not going to work. And so that was and that was that. But also, I mean, we had promoters kind of I could see the money in their eyes, you know, thinking, oh, this would be great. We could sell this like every which way all over the place as a package. And I went, yeah, you could, but what are we actually going to do?
Right.
You know, there's going to be 3 of us on stage. What are we going to do that's actually different, that's really cool? And the song on the solo album, The Tyranny of Souls,
right.
The song Tyranny of Souls was the only song that I wrote for that project, which was designed for 3 voices. And the demo of it, I actually... did almost like impressions of a Rob version, the Jeff Tate bit, and my bit, and split them up. And when we go into the big chorus of Tyranny of Souls, obviously all 3 of us would be singing together like a big choir. And doing that song, I thought, yeah, that would kind of work. But I need another 12 songs like that to do a whole performance, because
right.
Otherwise it's just a novelty thing. You can't do things just because of the novelty value. You should do things because musically they're real, you know.
I've got 60 seconds, and this is really important because the book ends with your cancer and your battle and your victory over cancer. One thing that the book ends at this point, anybody that saw Maiden on the most recent tour on Book of Souls, phenomenal shows, phenomenal performances by you in particular. I mean, vocally, the way you moved on stage, there was a concern about that from Maiden fans with what you had just went through and the battle you'd waged. How did you feel, and how do you feel now? Is your prognosis good?
Yeah, I mean, I go back every... as you get further and further away from being given the green light and it's all good, you get checked less and less, you know. So come next year, I think it's I go back every kind of 6 months, you know, unless I want to go for a beer with my oncologist, you know, which actually he deserves more than a beer.
I was going to say probably not a bad thing to do to keep him close.
He's a good guy.
You know? All right, thanks to Bruce Dickinson for being my guest on this week's Eddie Trunk Podcast. Remember, new episodes every Thursday, podcast1.com, and iTunes are the place to stream them or download them totally free. Appreciate you guys all around the world listening and making this a top 10 podcast on iTunes all the time. I really do appreciate all the support. I do hear from you guys, and I'm sorry if I can't reply to every single email, but know that I check them all out. If you want to email me, it's eddie@eddietrunk.com. And again, the social media, @EddieTrunk, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and the website with all my appearances. Merch store is there too. Some great new merch designs are coming soon. Hope you guys get a chance to check them out and have a look at some new stuff that's going to be developed soon for merch. But there's some great stuff there already, and the holidays are close, so order now and take advantage of some sales we're going to be doing in the merch store. Again, you'll find it on eddietrunk.com. Signed copies of my books, if you want to buy them directly from me, you hit the books tab, I'll get those out to you as well. And again, my appearances are there, music news updated daily, all on the website. Hey, you guys have a great week. I'll see you next Thursday for another all-new edition of the Eddie Trunk Podcast. Thank you.
everybody. I'm Heather Dubrow.
And I'm Dr. Terry Dubrow.
Every Friday, check out my podcast, Heather Dubrow's World.
We also have the Dr. and Mrs. Guinea Pig Show every Tuesday.
So don't forget iTunes and Podcast One. Tune in to Dr. and Mrs. Guinea Pig on Tuesdays and Heather Dubrow's World every Friday.